Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is a conversation recorded in 1987 with William R. Allen, a former professor of economics at UCLA and former host of the Midnight Economist radio series. Allen, intent on proving quality of economic education, believes journalists, politicians, and most teachers don't understand or choose to ignore the lessons of economics. He's also troubled by the well-intentioned efforts of people to promote free enterprise. We hope you enjoy today's views. And stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Hello, I am William Allen. I profess truth in the Department of Economics at UCLA. I'm also Vice President of the Institute for Contemporary Studies. And as an economist, I find much to worry about in the world. I suppose economists are as well equipped as any other professional group to find things to fret about. It is, after all, a world of scarcity, and therefore a world of conflict and competition, and of woe and tyranny. And economists, at least those economists who understand their business, tend, therefore, to be restrained and pessimistic. All is not lost, but there are costs to be borne and prices to be paid to get what we want in a world of limitations. All this sounds, I suppose, pretty elementary. It is. It's also elemental. The notions of scarcity and price and cost and choices and options lie at the very core of economics. That's what economics is all about. The question which concerns me in particular at this moment is not economics in the large, however. It's how to convey good, solid, well-established, well-founded economics to an audience beyond economists. Economists tend to talk to each other. Sometimes they don't make themselves understood even to another economist. And they rarely have much effect in getting through to the great unwashed, be it undergraduates on the university campus, or editorial writers on newspapers, or members of Congress and others in government. As a matter of fact, most economists, and I would say especially the senior, best-established economists, do not even make any great attempt to spread the word of their technique and their knowledge to non-specialists. I don't know that most economists actually think it beneath them, but it doesn't inspire them either. And they would much rather confine themselves to talking to other professionals about arcane matters in arcane fashion. And to a point, that's perfectly all right. Specialists do indeed have to deal with other specialists. They convey what they have learned, and they learn things from others who have carried on their own research. So that's perfectly all right. But someplace along the line, the economics profession surely ought to try to reach out beyond fellow professional economists. And even beyond students in the classroom, the young braves they are trying to introduce to all this arcane analysis. That is to say, there is a teaching function which goes beyond the college campus, a teaching function to reach the community at large. There's nothing supercilious or condescending in this remark, far from it. None of us is an authority in everything. Indeed, few are authorities in anything. And so I do not blame the community at large for not being good economists. But since they are not, it behooves those who do specialize in economics to share some of their accumulated knowledge, their techniques of analysis, their conclusions on what works and what doesn't work well, with intelligent lay types. So that is my focus for today, economic education in the broad. Economic education going beyond the classroom and trying to reach the community at large. It's a big problem, but one worth considering.
And the objective, as you stated, is to profess the truth. Well, in an attempt to do that, what's the most common misperception of what constitutes economic education?
Well, few people, I think, have much of a notion of what economics is or what economists do. That makes it easier, of course, to joke about economists. Most jokes are amusing precisely because they miss the mark. This is not unique to economics. One can joke about clergymen or astronomers and others. But joking has to do with exaggeration and misperception. Economics has to do primarily with scarcity and the implications of scarcity. We simply cannot have all that we want. Even in this land of milk and honey, we have to make do with less than we should like to have. Everyone is faced with the condition of scarcity. Now, some things are more scarce to some people than they are to others, to be sure. The playboy has his own priorities and interests. He suffers his own peculiar forms of scarcity. The monk does not share many of the preferences of the playboy, but he has problems of scarcity of his own. If nothing else, he has scarce time and energy for prayer and meditation. So we all are faced with limitations. The most immediate consequences and implications of the fact of scarcity have to do with choice making. Since we can't have all of everything, we have to pick and choose. And if you choose this, then you forego that. And that immediately gets you into the notion of cost, which is about as fundamental as economists can get. For cost in its nature is foregone alternatives, what you have to give up or trade off to get the thing in question which you want. And this is resisted, this notion, by most people, including college students who supposedly are open to analysis and to new ideas. If you tell a student, for example, that we bear costs to have clean air and clean water, and as a matter of fact, the costs are surely too large to have perfectly clean air and clean water, and that some amount of pollution is optimal because it would be too costly to have pristine air and water, he resists. And indeed, he will, with some belligerence, denounce you, for he doesn't like that conclusion. He may follow the line of thought right up to the conclusion. He may accept the definitions, the concepts. He will nod his head in agreement as you trace it through step by step. And then you come to the grand conclusion of it all, namely that there are costs to be borne and that some pollution is better than no pollution because the costs of having no pollution are too great. And then he suddenly rebels. This is the kind of mindset, if you please, which any teacher and economist perhaps more than most are faced with.
Well, as we discuss economics, I'd like to consider first a couple definitions. Would you define macro and microeconomics?
You're assuming that there is one of each. There are those who would say there's only microeconomics and no macro. I think that's going a bit far and being rather precious. But the essence of economics, the foundation, the basis, the real guts of economics is micro. Micro is in microscope. That is, you're looking at the small elements and the individual actors in the scene. You're talking about the particular consumer, the individual household, the business firm. The industry is about as far as you go in aggregation. And you're talking about the prices of particular goods and the prices of particular inputs. So it's the small elements of the economy in microeconomics, otherwise known as price and allocation analysis. Now, this is fundamental, for the ultimate unit of analysis surely is the individual. It is the individual person, not a team, not a corporation, not a nation, certainly, which makes decisions. It is individual people who survey the scene, look at their options, see what the opportunities may be, who calculate, who try to make do as well as they can with the scarce resources available to them, who make decisions and then bear the consequences, good or bad, of those decisions. And until you know how the world looks to an individual, until you appreciate his view of his options and alternatives, unless you note to what he deems to be his incentives and disincentives, then you don't really understand why that decision was made. Now, there's a temptation simply to stop the economics right there. Economists have a great deal to say, which I think is very useful, on microeconomics. But there are other aspects of economics which, in their nature, involve big averages and big aggregates. And you have to talk in big summary statements in order to deal with the problem at all. Inflation, for example. You talk about the price level or the price index. Well, the price index, of course, is made up of all these hundreds and thousands of individual prices. But you can't pause at every inch along the way and talk about 10,000 prices. So you talk about an average price or a price index and what makes it move up or down. And this gets you into such things as monetary policy. So inflation, employment, tariff policy, taxation policy, national income, these are all conspicuous topics in so-called macroeconomics, where you deal with the big averages and the big aggregates. And I do not at all begrudge this sort of thing. How could one begrudge it? These are important topics. But I think we ought to note that there is something of a chasm, even within the profession, between the micro and the macro. People sort of instinctively shift gears when they go from one to the other. And we're trying to build bridges over that chasm to bring the micro and the macro together. Now, to the extent that you can bridge the chasm and make it essentially one economics, because after all, there's only one world out there to analyze, those bridges have to be founded and based on the micro side of the chasm. Then you throw over the bridge to hook up with the macro problems. It's not the other way around. I know of no bridges which are based on the macro considerations and then are thrown over to the micro. So you start with microeconomics, and then as occasion requires, and it will require from time to time, we have to talk in macro terms.
Well, that was helpful. What about markets? There's another term. We listen to TV, market this, market that. What's the economist mean by market?
Oh, a market is, in essence, more a process than a place. Now, the process or processes may be congregated, typically, in a certain geographic location. And so you can talk about going to the market, the supermarket, the pharmacy, or what have you. But what we're doing is exchanging information. People who have things to sell want to convey this information. They want to tell you the terms on which they're willing to sell, the qualities of the products, and so forth. And of course, the people who want to buy want to learn these things. So the market is a mechanism, an institutionalized mechanism, sometimes highly formalized, in which or through which people can get together and exchange information and make bids and offers, dicker, and sometimes make a deal.
Going back to Bill Allen, at what
point... That's one of my favorite subjects.
I thought it would be. At what point in your own education did you first encounter economics?
You said in my education, so you mean formally.
Yes.
I say that because, of course, we all necessarily are practicing economists. Anyone old enough to have a thought at all has to make comparisons and choices and decisions. So far as formal education goes, well, I had a course in economics as a freshman. It was not a particularly inspiring course, or to put it more accurately, it rather inspired one not to take another course. Most economics is badly taught. Economics is not unique in that respect. Mathematics, I think, is even worse taught, typically, which is highly unfortunate on both counts. But I have an older brother who was and is, though now retired, a professional economist. And in the summer between my junior and senior years in college, I lived with him when he was teaching at Northwestern. I was a history major at the time, actually combination history and political science, and still find those fields very interesting. History is interesting. Historians, I sometimes find it difficult to tolerate. And he persuaded me during that summer that I could retain my interest in history and political science, the processes of politics and the activities in general of mankind, which is the province of historians, but at the same time specialize in the analytic field of economics. History and political science and most of sociology and English literature and such things are not very analytic in a formal restricted sense of the term. I don't mean to be beastly toward these fields or their practitioners, except when they deserve it. These are perfectly splendid fields, but they're not analytic fields in the sense of formally, deliberately, rigorously deriving answers. Historians are very erudite. They know lots of stuff. And you can hope that they tell a good story. That makes it fun to read what they have to write. And they can be systematic. They can tell a good story. They can be sensible and wise. But for all that, they still don't solve problems. Henry IV of France was assassinated in 1610, you recall. Well, you don't figure that out. You don't deduce it. No model derives that answer. You either know it or you don't know it. Now, to be sure, history is more than just memorizing dates. But even so, history is a literary art more than an analytic science. So I was rather intrigued when my brother talked to me in terms of a problem-solving sort of discipline. And indeed, he suggested I might be an economic historian and I could combine the two fields. I have done that to a very modest degree, economic history and intellectual history both, along with economics. But it dates from that. I went ahead and completed my undergraduate degree in history and political science and then shifted to economics as a graduate student. And the rest is personal history.
Yes. Well, I assume then that economics was not widely taught in high school at that time, just prior to World War II.
Not that I'm aware of. There were social studies or civics and this sort of thing. And you can't very well talk about government and public policy without getting into some aspects of economics. But certainly in my high school, and it was a very good high school, there was no formal training in economics, and of course there would have been no one around to have taught it, even if they had wanted to give the course. I will assert that there still is very little economics taught in high school, even though there are now many economics courses.
Had I interviewed you at your high school graduation, what would you have told me was your goal in life?
Oh, as a profession, in those days, I wanted to be a cartoonist. Walt Disney was my hero. I was really pretty good, not so much at originating cartoon figures as in copying, not tracing, but copying Mickey Mouse and Snow White and the rest of the characters. I still occasionally do a bit of doodling. I think maybe that's why I liked geometry a good deal, something which is visual. I was better in geometry than in algebra. I like deduction, and I also like to see something decently substantial, something I can manipulate. Equations have kind of an ethereal, esoteric quality about them. But in those days, yes, it was heavily cartooning, though I was in the process of giving that away as a childlike interest. Mm-hmm. And then World War II became my interest. And I very nearly went into the Army Air Corps on graduation from high school. The enemy waited long enough for me to get in a semester of college before I won World War II single-handed.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. The world is better for it.
I think so decidedly, though, you know, there are people who otherwise seem quite sensible who now insist that really it was all a kind of foolishness and therefore a mistake. We should never have been involved. I'm one of those who think that it was really quite literally vital that the Allies win that war.
Well, that could take us down an entire hour of discussion of foreign policy, but I'll pass on that. I want to come back to economics.
I'm an authority on that, too, you understand.
Yes, I'm sure of it. Is it, this one will start you. Is it fair to consider economics the study of all human behavior?
Oh, let me equivocate. It's yes and no. I think these days, in contrast to maybe a full generation ago, take it back half a century, is now looked upon as a much more Catholic-type discipline. You go back, and I'm saying quite arbitrarily, 50 years, and the field was pretty clearly delineated. There were some topics which were economics in nature and other things were not. But since World War II, there have been some very ingenious, innovative, insightful individuals who have pushed out the boundaries of application of basic economic analytics. The analytics are still pretty much easily discernible as, in quotes, economics. I mean, you're dealing with costs and receipts, and you're dealing with maximization and marginal changes and this sort of thing, which are the meat and drink of economic analytics. But they can be applied and utilized in a vastly wide range of problems and topics. Things which used to be looked upon solely as sociology or anthropology or political science are now handled either by economists or by specialists in those fields with economic tools. So I would be loath to point my finger at any kind of economic or any kind of human activity or human institutions and say, those are clearly outside the realm of economics. Even if they haven't been dealt with so far, tomorrow somebody is apt to apply economic techniques to elucidating them further.
Well, the question of analysis comes to mind. You've talked about it quite a bit. And what I'm kind of stumbling over is that economists also talk about freedom, opportunity cost choices. These seem to go clearly at the core of human nature, but can they be quantified?
There are young geniuses running around the economics profession these days who seem to have very little interest in anything which cannot be measured at the fourth decimal place, in anything which cannot be computerized. This is highly unfortunate. Not everything worth considering in this veil of tears is subject to that kind of technique. Let us utilize the computerizing and the econometrics and what have you so far as they are useful. But there are additional things to take into account. And certainly when you get into the realm of what is freedom, what constitutes a good society, and so forth, then obviously we are dealing with things which on the one hand are momentous and basic and elemental, but on the other hand are hardly subject to a rigorous mathematical demonstration. I suggest that most economists who share more or less my perspective and predilections, which is to say the good economists in the profession, the respectable ones, do have a great interest in human freedom, in liberty. Indeed, a few moments ago, I, in essence, alluded to that. I said that the individual is the ultimate unit of analysis, for he is the one who does the observing and the consideration and the decision-making and bears the consequences and so forth. And I think most reputable economists are much inclined, highly inclined, to say that that society is best which, in quotation marks, maximizes the range of options, which gives fullest scope to individual investigation and consideration and choice. Certainly that is my own view, and I consider it a red flag, red used advisedly, I guess, when people start talking to me about trying to roll up their sleeves and make over America, which was a New Deal expression, or who want to use the police power of the state to make decisions for us dull-witted sorts who don't really understand what is best for us and who want to keep us from doing things which we really do want to do, but they insist that if we were as wise and knowledgeable as they and as humane and sensitive as they, we wouldn't really want to do it at all. And I suggest that there's nothing magical about joining government. One does not acquire instant wisdom and erudition and humaneness the moment he enters the confines of Washington, D.C. This is not a plea for anarchy. I am not an anarchist. Neither was Adam Smith. You can't very well have an economy based on private rights to use of property without having government. For it is government, the community working through government, which specifies what those rights are, which lays down the ground rules as to what I can do with what assets and what I cannot do with those assets. It is institutions of the community, which I will call government, which adjudicate disputes and enforce those rules. So I am no anarchist, but I want a severely constrained government. And whenever the issue is in doubt, some particular proposal of government activity comes along, if there's any doubt, then my presumption is that it's a bad proposal to increase the discretionary powers of government.
Well, as an economist working with the theoretical tools you have, it seems to me my observation is that you can develop rules that seem to lead to a maximization of personal choice, personal freedom. But how do you deal with the question of whether people prefer freedom?
What is preference, and what does it mean to prefer something? Now, if I'm not careful, I'm going to start sounding like one of the Big Brother types who says that I am sufficiently wise and sophisticated that I know better than you what you ought to want. I certainly don't want to come off looking like that. But I am suggesting, first, that people pretty obviously do like to choose. In any case, they are in a world where choices have to be made. Even people who, by material standards, are poor have choices to make. And indeed, the poorer you are, the shrewder you'd better be in making those choices. You don't have resources to waste in frivolous fashion. So people necessarily are choice makers, even under a dictatorship. But what is the range of the choice, and what is the nature of the choices, and under what circumstances do you make those choices? Here, communities differ greatly. We all are faced with scarcity. We all, therefore, are faced with conflict and competition and costs in choice making. But communities differ tremendously in the ground rules, which is a way of saying property rights. Now, not everyone clutches to his bosom a maximum range of choice making. That is surely true. We don't know how people would behave if they had been brought up under different circumstances. But a given individual, an adult, who has lived for 20 or 40 or 60 years in certain circumstances and has built up a certain orientation, a style of living, he's used to certain things, will get used to making choices in certain ways. And now if you dump him abruptly in a different environment, it may very well be confusing. We have lots of anecdotal evidence on this. Immigrants coming into this country are overwhelmed by the choices. There was a person I have read about who, with great difficulty, got out of Russia and moved to this country. He was overjoyed. The land of freedom, everybody can do what he wants, and of course the streets are paved with gold. All his problems were over. And he discovered that, well, there still were a few problems left. There were still decisions to be made. There were still costs to be borne. Rather than saying, well, it isn't heaven, presumably, but still it's a happy situation and I have more range for freedom than I had before, he took the view, according to the newspaper account, that, well, there were too many choices. It was confusing. He wasn't used to being that responsible. He was afraid, as his wife said, that he would make a fool of himself by the bad choices, and so there ought to be more government regulation. Well, I look upon this as a form of brainwashing. I have no reason to suppose that the genes and hormones of people who have been brought up in Russia are essentially different from ours. If they had been brought up in the land of the free, they would have gotten used to freedom. But to be exposed to freedom abruptly can indeed create problems. And my concern now is, because Russia does exist and Red China does exist and so forth, and there's not an awful lot we can do about that overnight, my concern is with our own community. How well do we play our own game? Are we afraid of freedom in this country? We were born free. Do we appreciate it? Do we understand the prerequisites of freedom? Do we understand the processes of freedom? Do we understand the challenges to freedom? Do we understand that when we vote for people because they promise us comparable worth legislation or minimum wage laws or rent controls, that we are in fact cutting our throat of freedom and efficiency? The two go hand in hand. It's pretty apparent that not everyone understands these nuances. It can get fairly subtle. Everyone says, don't tread on me. I'm a free man. It's a free country. And then he turns right around and votes for rent control. This is not very subtle economics.
Well, that's for sure. Making distinctions, I'd like to touch on one more and then come back to the question of general question of economic education. And that is the difference between finance and economics.
I am no authority on finance, but of course there are different aspects of it. I did, in fact, earn my daily bread very largely over one era by specializing in international finance. But that was in my guise as an economist, not as a banker or a foreign exchange dealer or whatever. Finance is one of these institutional considerations which are vitally important, of course. It's a part of the machinery and the process through which the community makes its economic decisions. Terribly grubby, however. One can be, I think, very shrewd in many financial-type positions, a stockbroker, perhaps, and not be much of an economist. You would have to be knowledgeable on all sorts of tax laws and that sort of thing. You ought to be aware of sources of information on data. You ought to keep up on proposals of this and that, which will affect how people earn their living and pay what taxes and so forth. So you ought to be very knowledgeable. But a CPA might be a very useful financial advisor and still be really quite innocent as an economist. An economist, after all, is a social scientist, as the expression goes. You can agree with the adjective, if not the noun. He is not a technician in the sense of the accountant or the stockbroker.
Is your goal to have everyone in society understand economics?
Well, I hope not, because that's asking for vast frustration. It will never be the case that everyone will be a reputable economist. I would settle for every member of an economics department being a reputable economist. We haven't reached that point yet. No, I don't anticipate that. But it doesn't greatly bother me either. I would like to see more subtlety, more sophistication, to be sure. How could I want otherwise? No society at any time has ever been populated primarily, or even largely, much less completely, of people who are at all sophisticated economic analysts. And yet life goes on. The world works after a fashion, and it works best when there is less centralized direction. This economy, by and large, over two centuries, has prospered. It's been an oasis of abundance, relatively speaking, as well as freedom. But not because everybody was an economist. Obviously, that was not the case. Now, let me throw this in. While I do not have a high regard for the average, typical level of professional sophistication in economics exhibited by the public at large, this is not at all the same thing as saying that people are dumb or slow-witted or not very bright in handling their own affairs. I suspect strongly, I think I have some reason to believe, that typically people are pretty shrewd in handling their own affairs. They're even quite knowledgeable on those things which immediately impact on them. They know whether or not they're eligible for Social Security, for example. They know what the price of lettuce is these days. They know how much it costs to ride the bus to work. And so forth, and indeed on even bigger matters than those I have mentioned. So they are not dumb, they're not unshrewd, they are not uninformed on those things which impinge quite directly and immediately on their personal concerns. They become veritable children analytically, however, when we move beyond those things in which they have personal expertise. And one is not born with knowledge of monetary analysis or price theory or what have you. This has to be gained by working laborious hours and by practicing it over a prolonged period. And I can't expect the bus driver or the architect or the surgeon or the policeman to make that investment in formal academic type economic analysis. So people are good in handling their own business. They are not good professional economists.
Well, what does the citizen do then when he's confronted with, in a democracy, having to choose political candidates who are out there saying, well, we should have free trade, we should have tariffs, we should have import quotas, and all these other problems that politicians say they will solve? How does the citizen make out which is the correct choice here without having the understanding which you're saying is very difficult to acquire?
Well, of course, they don't make out well, at least not deliberately and consciously well. I don't know how most people do arrive at these conclusions. Is it jungle instinct? A wetted finger to the breeze? You flip a coin? I don't know how most people decide how to vote. I think we can say with assurance that it is not on the basis of highly sophisticated economic analysis. But that is to say what they don't do, and I'm not sure what they do do. And it is a rather fearsome thing. I find it very sobering. The Republic has lasted for a couple of centuries. I hope this does not turn out to be a brief aberration in world history. But if our long-term future depends on subtle sophistication in economic analysis, then we surely are doomed. And I am not happy in looking at the tactics of the campaign. It's not so much a matter of damning the participants in the campaigns. Given the situation, they do what they can do. But now, realistically, how much analysis can be accomplished in a 30-second television spot? You hardly even try. That's not what the game is about. You try to look pretty. You try to be articulate. You try to look statesmanlike. You try to look calm. And you try to suggest, more or less directly, that the opposition is an ignorant boob. But you don't engage in economic analysis. And if you bought 30 minutes of airtime, which might give you an opportunity to say something, after the first two or three minutes, there would be no audience. So I guess it's jungle instinct and the grace of the deity which sees us through.
Well, you've started to mention the intermediaries. We've been talking about the professional economists on one end and the citizen on the other, but there are a lot of intermediaries in between. And what about the journalist and the commentator? Are these people that are economic literates, if you want to use that rather overused phrase?
Very few indeed. I would be hard-pressed to name any, really. There is Robert Samuelson, who writes a very respectable economics column. But you very quickly reach the end of the list. The beautiful people on television who speak with dulcet tones and clipped enunciation are at best amateur historians and political scientists and sociologists. I am not aware of any particular economics background of a formal nature on the part of any of the anchor types. Editorial writers of newspapers may be a slightly more sophisticated breed. Most of them probably are not, and yet you may get some people who at least are dealing with the written word, and in writing you have occasion to redo and strike out and look at it and come back to it. In contrast to the broadcast media, when, as in my situation now, you shoot from the hip. But by and large, the journalistic types are showbiz people, of course. They're after audiences and ratings. That's what their game is about. And the economics suffers greatly.
So they shoot from the hip with a gun loaded with blanks.
Well, I don't know. Is it blanks or is it dum-dum bullets aimed at free market types like me? For there does seem to be a rather consistent bias There surely is some evidence suggesting so. Against open markets, against maximizing personal choice making, against individual responsibility in handling your own affairs, and in favor of the rules and the regulations and the interventions and all on the part of Big Brother. It is, as the expression goes, unhappily, a very liberal sort of occupation. I'm speaking of journalism in general, broadcast and print as well.
Well, if people choose freedom, and if economic analysis leads one to conclude that freedom is maximized by going in the direction of less control rather than more, why then this prevailing bias?
Well, to persuade, you have to get the word across, or to learn, you have to hear the word. And where and how does the community in general learn anything about what I would call sound and solid, well-formulated, well-established economic analysis? They don't get it in grade school and high school. They usually don't get it in college. A fair proportion of the students may take a course, but they are still a minority. And economics, as I mentioned a moment ago, is badly taught. And so they leave college. Sometimes I think it's even worse. If people have had just a course or two in economics, that may be worse than having none at all. Because having taken a course or two and passed it, they are under the delusion that they understand something about the subject. And since they understand, in fact, very little, they're dangerous. They're dangerous to themselves and dangerous to others when they vote. So how do you get to the great mass of the community? Well, you try. I am known in some circles as the sound economist, otherwise known as the midnight economist. And I do have a syndicated series of economics essays on something like 70 to 75 stations around the country. How many stations are there? 2,500 or 10,000 or?
Yeah, some significant
large
number.
Larger than 70. And I'm in about 20 newspapers out of the hundreds of newspapers around the country. All I can say is that you brighten the corner where you are. You seriously, not grimly, but seriously, do the best you can. You try to make material which can easily become esoteric and arcane manageable by people who have a brain, who are willing to make some intellectual investment, but who have not been tutored in economics. You try to make it manageable by the intelligent layman. And then you approach the channels of distribution. You go to the radio stations, you go to the newspapers, and you try to persuade them that their clientele would appreciate some non-hysterical, hard-nosed, straightforward, but decently well-presented economics. Goodness knows they are not getting it by and large in the editorials. They're not getting it from the syndicated columnists, with very few exceptions. So how about adding the Midnight Economist to your stable? And a few have, as I have indicated. Most have not.
You've expressed great concern about this growth of government many times in your comments. It's increased interference with individual choices. Could you give us an example of economic analysis that supports that concern, a good example that would convince us that?
Well, how about the minimum wage? This is a topic which has been hot for some while, and we haven't seen the last of it, goodness knows. Who could be against the minimum wage? Only a Scrooge. Everybody can see. You're born with the knowledge. It's inbred jungle instinct that it is nice to have a floor under wages. That in this land of milk and honey, relatively speaking, certainly $4.50 or whatever, $4.25, is little enough. That barely brings you over the officially stipulated poverty level. So as an anti-poverty program, as an aid to poor people, we will pass a minimum wage law. And Fat Daddy Warbucks simply has to pay it. That's right and proper. And everybody applauds like mad, and you get elected to Congress that way. may even get elected to the presidency that way. Well, this is a classic illustration, in fact, of unforeseen consequences. At least I kind of like to hope it's unforeseen. I sometimes wonder if the people who advocate minimum wage legislation really do believe what they say. Can they be so innocent? But whether they are innocent and don't know any better, or whether they are devious and do know better, this is what they advocate, and they advocate it in the name of the poor and the downtrodden. That isn't the way it works. Many a noble-sounding objective, when pursued, does more harm than good. What you are doing with a minimum wage is taking options away from people who already are in trouble. A poor person is already having difficulty in competing in the labor market. He wouldn't be poor otherwise. Why is he having trouble competing? Well, in one way or another, or some combination, he's not very attractive. He just isn't valued very highly. It may be he has the wrong color of skin. He may have the wrong nationality, the wrong religion. He may talk funny. He doesn't have a lot of formal education. His very name sounds peculiar. Maybe he's from the wrong part of the country. There's something wrong with him. He may be very bright. He may be very pure in heart. But he just isn't very attractive. And then you add to that lack of education, perhaps lack of age and experience, you have a package here which isn't worth very much in the labor market. No one is going to pay very much for it. Now you come to this person and you say to him, look, you've been working for $2 an hour. That isn't very much. That's pitiful. I'm going to see to it that you're paid more than that. I'm going to make it illegal for you to do what you have been doing. What you have been doing is entering into an agreement with an employer to work for $2 an hour. I'm now going to make it illegal for you and the employer to get together and strike that bargain. And I'll lean on both of you if I catch you doing that. Well, so now what's supposed to happen? Well, what's supposed to happen, of course, is the employer will say, well, if I can't get him for $2, I'll pay him $4.25. And life goes on, except that the worker now has double the income he had before. What is actually going to happen in many instances is the employer is going to say, look, this individual was worth, but barely worth, $2 an hour. It would make no sense for me whatsoever to double his pay. And indeed, if I start paying more for inputs than they are worth, I no longer will be an employer. I'll be out of business. And there go the jobs which now I am supplying. So what you're doing is cutting down on the options of people. You are diminishing their capacity to compete. And this is vital. For if you are under any kind of handicap, and we all have handicaps of one sort or another, the way to compete is to say, look, I will sell my services on more attractive terms than the next guy. I will offset or counterbalance my inadequacies and my unattractiveness by taking a lower price. But now, if you come along and make it illegal for me to do that, you've run me out of the game. You've priced me out of the market. And that is surely what is going to happen. What, in fact, has happened? It is simply factually incorrect to say, as some economists, so-called, have said, that there is no evidence that raising the minimum wage in the past has had dire consequences. They certainly have had dire consequences, these increases in the minimum wage. All you can say is that when you talk about the national averages of employment and inflation and so forth, it doesn't show up very conspicuously. But that's simply because the people affected are swamped by the rest of the economy. Go to the people who are immediately directly affected, the people who now don't have a job because they can't compete because of the Minimum Wage Act, and to tell those people there are no dire consequences. I think it's outrageous when purported economists simply garble and indeed falsify the analysis and the record.
Would it be your minimum goal in an economics class or in talking to citizens to get them to look beyond appearances at actual results?
Well, that's very much what the game is about. It is not the whole game, of course. You start with a core of analytics and you quite explicitly trace through. But when you get into anything like a subtle elaboration, when it gets beyond just the most kindergarten of analysis, then you have to take into account the long term as well as the short, and the indirect effects as well as the direct. And this is pretty much what separates the big boys from the small, and the good economists from the less good economists. Do you have the imagination, the insight, the innovative powers to distinguish the long term as well as the short term consequences, and the indirect as well as the direct?
Should every college student be required to take economics? Would that help the...
Well, I would be reluctant to make that requirement for college students or high school students either, for it depends on the product they're given. Now, if you require everyone at UCLA to take my Principles of Economics course, that might make the world a better place. And indeed, a fair proportion of the population does, but it's a good deal less than 100%. No, economics is badly taught. It's badly taught both in the sense of just classroom mechanics. Some people don't explain things well. They're not very patient. They don't have a gift for illustration and this sort of thing. It's badly taught also because there are people running around with PhDs in economics, and indeed who have risen to very considerable professional eminence because they have published much, who never have really quite caught the tune of what it's all about. Mark Twain once said that his wife had learned all the swear words, but she'd never learned how to carry the tune. Well, this again separates the good economists from the bad. Anybody with a PhD in economics knows an awful lot of formal technical words. They can bend the curves and solve the equations and throw the terminology around and do the mechanics. But how do you use it to elucidate the nature of the world? To explicate these things of some subtlety? How do you determine the applications of the basic analytics to explain things which are not just perfectly obvious and which jungle instinct alone will not tell you? This gift, and it's, I think, largely a God-given gift. It can be developed and refined, but there has to be something there to develop in the first place, is possessed by not many. This is not intended as a personal boast. I think I have more of a feel for economics than a good many people in the fraternity, but I am not one of the giants of the profession in this respect, or indeed in any other respect. But there is that handful, that blessed handful, of people who have learned to carry the tune, who, as one person put it, can find economics under every rock, who find a use and an application and an illustration for these tools which everybody knows. But simply having the toolkit doesn't mean that you're a master carpenter.
The average working citizen seems to think that the business community, the businessman, understands economics. Do they?
No, not typically. That's not intended as a snide remark. I know a fair number of business people. Some of them are even my friends. And I have very high regard for some. These are intelligent, able, very hard-working people who have made great investment in their career, and they add much value. They are valuable to the community. Then there are others. This is true of every profession. I've already noted it's true of economics. There are good economists and then some who are not so good, and certainly the same is true in the business community. Unhappily, business people, including some who are very good business people, who are very good at what they do, suppose that because they are good business people, they are also good economists. Well, when they say so, and say so, I'm sure, sincerely, it simply reflects the fact that they don't really know very well what economists do. No, it's one thing to solve business problems, to bear that strain, that burden, that responsibility, to deal with people, to be able to discern somehow, partly through jungle instinct, who are the responsible, reliable people? Who should be on your team? Should we expand or contract? Should we raise price or lower it? Who have that kind, have the kind of information on the basis of which such decisions are made? This requires great accumulation of knowledge and shrewdness, but it doesn't mean that you're a good economist. And I run across that frequently. The painful thing is when these people think that they are a good economist, and they want to be. There are business people, and I do not laugh at them. I'm not scorning them here at all. In fact, I'm applauding them, basically, who want to be people of thought and erudition, as well as first-rate administrators of businesses. So they like to read, and they like to talk to people who read. They like to bounce ideas back and forth. I certainly don't want to discourage that. But simply because you have catholicity of interest and because you have energy to try to go beyond your immediate day-to-day affairs and branch out into wider avenues of thought and consideration, because you have the interest doesn't magically make you, therefore, a good economist.
Well, we as citizens face a rather interesting challenge, and that is how do we operate effectively in a democracy? Confronted with this problem of understanding economics, are there any questions that can be stated simply that the average citizen should be asking those who claim to have solutions to economic problems?
Oh, I suppose such questions, though they would have to be tailored to the situation, obviously, but such questions essentially as what are the gains and what are the costs and who bears them? In what way will who be better off? And will these people be better off immediately or after a lag? If they are made better off immediately, will they continue to be made better off? Is the improvement essentially permanent? And what costs are to be borne? No matter what we do, whenever we have to make a choice, we bear costs because we forego something else in getting what we want to get. So what are the costs? And who bears them? Even if you are pretty well persuaded that the returns or the rewards or the benefits are greater than the cost, you still then can go on to another level of sophistication and ask, well, have we maximized the net returns? Have we opened up the biggest excess of returns over costs? Because that, of course, is what we really are aiming at. Now, this will make the congressman or the other candidate squirm. He's not used to thinking in such terms, by and large. He's used to thinking in terms of what he gains and what he loses when he votes in such and such a way or makes such and such a proposal. But you ask him now explicitly, overtly, and reasonably systematically to lay out on a platter for us who gains and who loses what, and are we maximizing the gains if indeed we're making net gains at all, then I think you're asking him to do things which he is not used to doing. And it might be good for his character to be put on the spot that way.
Well, in The Midnight Economist, you try to put people on the spot, and often you do so with the assistance of two little fellows, furry creatures, Adam and Carl Mouse. How did they come into existence?
Oh, of course, Mouse Adam represents Adam Smith, and Mouse Carl, Karl Marx. They are likable little fellows. Adam is knowledgeable and sensible and calm. Carl tends to be a bit hysterical and is always getting off on the wrong paw. But by the end of the 2 minute and 40 second commentary, Adam invariably has shown Carl the error of his ways in the process using good solid economics. The next broadcast, of course, he has to do it all over again. Carl learns rapidly, but doesn't remember very long.